How's it growing, folks? Welcome back again to Here We'd Go, the podcast dedicated to introducing and educating you, the listener, about the wonderful world surrounding weed, aka cannabis. I'm your host, Eddie Celaya, the cannabis writer here at the Arizona Daily Star and TucsonMarijuanaGuide.com here in Tucson, Arizona. Oh, hey, by the way, Here We'd Go now has a Facebook page where you can look for the latest episodes and new content. And we have a companion newsletter, which you can sign up for at Tucson.com or by looking in the podcast description area for additional links. For this episode, I'm going back to school and learning the ABCs, or is that THCs, on terpenes, the entourage effect, and the new cannabinoid-based research that's happening here in southern Arizona in the field of pain management. Joining me for a roundtable discussion focusing on some of their cutting-edge work are three researchers from the University of Arizona's Comprehensive Pain and Addiction Center, Drs. Tally Largent-Milnes, John Stryker, and Todd Vandera. Dr. Largent-Milnes studies the role of the endocannabinoid system in functional pain disorders, including migraine. Dr. Stryker's research is exploring how cannabis terpenes affect pain. And Dr. Vandera is the interim director of the Pain and Addiction Center. Our wide-ranging discussion touches on the basics of what cannabinoids and terpenes are, what the supposed entourage effect is, and what the implications of some of this groundbreaking research is. The conversation picks up with my questions for Dr. Largent-Milnes.
I'd like to start off first with, I think, what would be the kind of, you know, first base of this, the easiest part to jump off. Dr. Largent-Milnes, what is the endocannabinoid system?
Oh, that's a great question. So when we think of the cannabinoid system, the first place people kind of go is the cannabis plant or marijuana. But our body actually has a natural system that has been termed the endocannabinoid system, where we have different proteins and fats that act at the same receptors as those compounds that can be found in the cannabis plant. And so some of those compounds are lipids like anandamide or 2-arachidonyl glycerol, and those act at these protein receptors that we call CB1 and CB2, where CB stands for cannabinoid. And then there's also this third component of proteins called enzymes, and those are proteins that actually will make and or degrade those lipid mediators, anandamide or 2-AG.
And so then talk to me, cannabinoids, are those things like THC and CBD? Are those things that interact with that system?
Yeah, so the cannabis plants have more than 200, probably more than 500 active components. And we think of cannabinoids themselves as anything coming from the plant or these endogenous mediators. And the chemicals that come from the plant, well, some of them will interact with those CB receptors, those cannabinoid receptors, like THC, or and then there are things like cannabidiol, which also come from cannabis, but they don't actually interact with the same proteins. They actually interact with different proteins. And so it can be a little bit misleading. So when we talk about cannabinoids themselves, it typically refers to the chemicals within the plant.
So talk to me then a little bit about your research and the studies that you've done having to do with that endocannabinoid system and migraines. Are migraines can they be mitigated by some of these cannabinoids, or is it a little bit more complex than that?
Well, as with most things, it's a little more complex than that, but there's some really interesting literature suggesting that of people who use cannabis, up to 36% are using cannabis to treat their headaches, which is a new finding in the last couple of years. But what really we're looking at is there was a clinical report showing that those endogenous signals, those lipids, were actually lower in patients who had migraine as compared to healthy controls. And so the lab really started to ask, you know, could that be, is it a chicken or the egg, right? Mm-hmm. Are they low because of the headache, or do they have a headache because they're low? And so when we were planning our studies and really looking at how to go after this, we actually asked both. So we induced headache and measured these endocannabinoid levels. And then we depleted those endocannabinoid levels and then measured headache. And what we found was that it's really reciprocal. So that when you have headache, there are lower levels of the endocannabinoids within the brain. And then when you deplete those endocannabinoid levels, that actually induced a prolonged headache. But what was interesting was that it seemed to be sex selective. Migraine tends to be a functional pain disorder that affects more women than men. It's very much tied to hormone levels. And so that was really an interesting finding for us, that we could recapitulate that presentation with just a very simple manipulation in the lab.
I guess then, what are the implications of this? Is it, akin to that, or kind of adjacent to that, for participants in this study, were they actually asked to use cannabis in some way? How was it administered or not administered?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I'm actually not a clinical researcher. So all of our work has been done in the preclinical setting using different rodent models. However, there have been some other studies done out of UCLA with the Wallace group, who has really shown that different strains of cannabis can be effective for headache. There was some recent studies out of Rebecca Kraft's lab at WSU in Washington showing that those, you know, the levels of THC versus something like CBD within the plant they didn't have to be variable to have effect against headache. And they also found that those same sex differences when inhaled, so they were using inhaled marijuana, were able to mitigate headache in the subset of patients that they studied.
So what are the implications then for this sort of research? Is it that, hey, maybe take an edible if you're having a migraine, or is that kind of beyond your recommendations right now?
I think at this point, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the goal would be that we can move into some of those clinical trials to actually ask that question, and then also ask the question, you know, does prolonged use lead to headache? And so there's evidence for many other anti-headache medications. The most commonly used substance, and that's going to be caffeine, right? And so prolonged use and then withdrawal of caffeine leads to headache. And so the same kind of questions and the implications of the research here are, if you prolong your use of cannabis, you know, can that lead to headaches? Does this deplete the endocannabinoid system? Is there a way that in that subset of patients, you know, we can maybe address this deficiency of the endocannabinoid system? And then I think we can also go beyond that and start to look at different efficacies between the sexes. And so a lot of what the work is kind of focused on is, we still, of all of the different types of anti-migraine or anti-headache therapeutics, most we think, oh, this might be effective. But in reality, 30 to 50% of patients have effect and beneficial effect 30 to 50% of the time. And so really trying to understand what the timing of the dosing needs to be, if people will use cannabis or other interventions, so that we can prevent these pathological changes. So the implication would be to understand the system to really identify a disease-modifying therapy that may have better efficacy in both male and female patients.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Dr. Stryker, your work deals with terpenes. Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, the first easiest way to start off with that is, what are terpenes? What do they do?
Yeah, absolutely. So everyone knows what terpenes are, even if you don't know what the word terpenes means. So these are these small chemicals in not just cannabis, all plants, that give the plants their aroma, their taste. So, you know, that nice zesty lemony smell, you smell a fresh lemon, well, that's D-limonene. You know, that sharp pine scent, that's beta-pinene found in pine trees. And so that's what terpenes are. And of course, we all knew that. That's what they are for many years. And there had been a little bit of research on what they did. But where our research came in is we started thinking about the cannabis plant, and specifically we started thinking about the entourage effect. So this is kind of a hot topic in the cannabis world, this idea that the different parts of the cannabis plant work together, that it's not just THC, that it's the minor terpenes, it's the flavonoids, it's the, you know, other types of minor cannabinoids, it's and maybe it's the terpenes too. So there are people out there like Leafly and others that will say that, you know, this terpene profile will give you this pharmaceutical effect. But there wasn't really a lot of research on any of that, right? And the research there was in terpenes is somewhat limited and not that convincing. So where we came in is we wanted to ask the question, could these terpenes have some kind of effect on their own that maybe could be contributing to like an entourage kind of thing? And so we started off by studying them on their own, just injecting them into mice and seeing what they did. And that's where we started.
So these terpenes then, were they derived from cannabis or were they derived from, obviously you said they come from lemons and other things. Yeah. Were they derived from those sources? And then can you kind of go back and explain a little bit for the listeners what that entourage effect is? What does that term really mean and where does it come from?
Well, I'm kind of laughing because that is a topic of hot debate right now. What is the entourage effect? Is it real? Does it even exist? And there's a lot of people that will tell you that it does, but they don't have a lot of data behind them. And there's a lot of people that will tell you that it's a bunch of nonsense. But there's really not a lot of data behind that either. So it's really kind of an open question, I would term it at this point, at least based on the scientific literature. And again, the entourage is this idea that the different parts of the cannabis plant are each going to have their own effect, and then they kind of synergize or build with each other to produce some effect that's unique. And I don't know how personal we want to get here, but you know, when I try different kinds of cannabis preparations, say a THC extract versus a full plant, the effect definitely feels different, right? And not necessarily in a way that you would expect. And so there could be something to that. And that's what we're really trying to dig in and figure out. And the way we did that is to build from first principles, is to study the isolated terpene. And that's where we get to your first question, is that we picked terpenes that are definitely in cannabis, but we didn't extract them from cannabis or do anything special in that way. So these were purified chemicals we bought from a supply company, just to start at that real basic level, reduce all the variables and just say, do these chemicals do something? And then we can build up to, are they doing something in the plant?
Gotcha, gotcha. And so I guess talk to me about your findings. What did you find? I guess you said that you isolated each terpene first by themselves and then put them together with a THC kind of extract or a THC kind of.
Yeah, we're still getting to kind of those, but at least in our first set of experiments that were published last year, we just injected it really on their own for the most part. And what we found was kind of interesting. So our first just hypothesis is just kind of like, well, you know, maybe these are going to look like cannabinoids because that seemed, I mean, we didn't really have any reason to believe that, but it's a good place to start. We'll test it and we'll see what happens. So somewhat to our surprise, the behaviors they produced were almost exactly like you would see with a cannabinoid like THC. Like it produced the same pain relief, it produced the same sedation, the same, you know, the same behavioral effects. And so that was kind of interesting. And then we dug in and tried to dig into the mechanisms. And we did at least find that at least the pain relief actually was going through the CB1 receptor, which is what Dr. Largent-Milnes just mentioned a few minutes ago. So, and then we also even did some cell model work to really show that these terpenes could stimulate and activate the cannabinoid 1 receptor. And at least they're producing some pain relief through the cannabinoid 1 receptor in mice, which is what we did all of our testing in. And so that was really kind of cool and unexpected and really what's gotten a lot of our interest in this paper. But then when we started to dig into more detail, say you get something like THC, pretty much all those behaviors are going to come through cannabinoid receptors. But with our terpenes, only one behavior went through cannabinoid receptor. The others did other receptors, which are not part of the endocannabinoid system, which Dr. Largent-Milnes mentioned. So you have other receptor systems which are being stimulated at the same time along with the endocannabinoid system to produce these behaviors. And so overall, it's what we called cannabimimetic. It looks like a cannabinoid-like effect. And then in particular, we're interested in the pain-relieving properties. So we can dig into that if you want.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about that because that's kind of what this episode is really focused on. What were the pain, you know, what did you find with those pain-relieving properties?
Yeah.
And then what are the implications? What are the applications for some of these findings?
Absolutely. So in the first paper, the one that's published, it was pretty basic. So we did sort of this hand on the hot stove style pain, this is acute nociceptive pain with heat. Like put your hand on the stove, you draw it back. You have a cannabinoid or an opioid or some other pain reliever, you leave it on the stove longer. That's basically what we did. So it's pretty simple. And what we found was that the cannab or the terpenes had this sort of this modest pain relieving property. It was detectable, but it wasn't huge. And that was mediated through the cannabinoid receptor. But then, you know, of course, hand on the hot stove pain is really not that relevant to people suffering from chronic pain. So in our further studies, which are unpublished as of now, but we're currently working on them, we hope to submit them soon, we started looking at chronic pain models. And in particular, we've looked at inflammatory pain, like, you know, kind of like, I'm trying to think of a human analog, but like, you know, strong inflammation producing pain, and then also pain that comes from chemotherapy. So patients are on these chemotherapy drugs, it causes a lot of damage, and that causes pain. And so we have these models, we looked at the terpenes, and to our surprise, but delight, the terpenes were actually much stronger in relieving pain in these chronic pain models than they were in that hand on the hot stove style pain, just as strong as morphine or a synthetic cannabinoid. So that was exciting.
Exactly. Yeah. At that point, you start to think like, wow, this could have a lot of real world applications. But
yeah, absolutely. And that's what we're starting to dig into in the rest of the paper, which we hope to publish soon, starting to look at things like side effects, right? Because if it relieves pain, but it makes you feel awful, what's the point? And so, you know, we found that it really, at least several of the terpenes really weren't producing these negative emotional effects in the animals. It wasn't making them feel bad. You know, the side effects were modest or low. And we even found that they combined with other pain relievers. So far, we've looked at combination with a synthetic cannabinoid or combination with morphine. And in both cases, you combine the two drugs together at a low dose, it produces pain relief much higher than either one alone, right? So that, and then that get then in terms of implication, that gives you the idea that you could potentially use terpenes as a sort of non-opioid, non-cannabinoid pain reliever, and or combine them with your other pain relievers to make them more effective while having lower side effects than either one alone.
Thank you so much for really diving into that research for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dr. Van der Raa, you know, you're the chair of the Department of Pharmacology. Talk to me a little bit about your history in academia and where you've seen research into cannabis come, especially there at the University of Arizona, where earlier or years ago, Dr. Seuss Isley was let go, you know, for research that, I mean, was pretty prominent at the time. And now we've got research like this that sounds pretty groundbreaking.
Thank you, Eddie. So yes, I've been here since 1997 as a professor, and even before that, doing my PhD degree. So I've been working on the area of pain and looking at novel compounds to inhibit pain for many, many years. And it started out, of course, researching opiates and trying to find alternatives to opiates. And eventually I started working on cannabinoids, knowing the idea that there's not much out there really that was known, you know, 20 years ago when you say, you know, what's known about cannabinoids. It was all about THC. And that really was most of the research. If you looked it up, it was always just papers on THC. And so I started to ask the question of, does something like medical marijuana contain other compounds in there that might actually be helpful for pain, both acute pain and chronic pain? And of course, our research is always done by the fact that we have to ask for federal funding. And it's always been difficult to get federal funding for researching something that was in the eyes of the federal government illegal. And so, but yet they still did support some of the research, knowing the idea that there may be something out there that could help in the area of using something like a cannabinoid or cannabis. And so the research went forward in the fact that we were lucky enough to get a grant to be able to study cannabinoids, but it was always with the idea that we were looking for something other than THC and something other than a compound that would result in rewarding behaviors with propensity of becoming addictive. And so a lot of the work that we did was actually looking at cannabinoids that would work at a receptor that did not produce euphoric effects. And so that's really sort of where my history started, by looking at what we thought were CB2 receptor agonists. And CB2 receptors were not on the neurons within the human brain. Now there's some controversy there, because as research goes on, you start to say, hey, maybe it does show up. Maybe it shows up after a certain pathology, after certain types of injury, or even after changes that occur. We do know it's on glial cells there. But anyway, it started with that type of research in which we could look at cannabinoids. We could get federal funding for it, but these were cannabinoids that wouldn't produce the rewarding behavior and therefore wouldn't likely become addictive. So that's really where this research started. Where is it today? Well, there's a huge growth in research. And you just heard from two professors here that talked about where the exciting new research is happening. And that is looking at the endogenous cannabinoid system. So as Dr. Largent-Milnes points out that there's plenty of ways that we can modulate one's own cannabinoid system to benefit in cases of like migraine, as well as using things like terpenes or combinations. And so a lot of the work that we've done recently is to, just as Dr. Stryker points out, we've looked at the combinations of using cannabinoids with opiates to determine whether we can really get a very good synergistic pain without producing those unwanted side effects.
So, and this kind of goes to that question about, your observation about how it's really hard to get those federal dollars. Going forward, especially with the proliferation of medical programs and now recreational programs at the state levels, where do you see this difficulty in getting those federal dollars? Do you see that ever subsiding? Do you see it becoming easier? Do you see it maybe becoming harder after this last Supreme Court ruling?
Hard to say what's going to happen in the future. However, it has gotten easier. There's been calls for grants, funding for looking at cannabinoids and novel types of things that come out of medical marijuana. And so it's definitely has gotten easier with medical marijuana as well as recreational marijuana being legal in the state of Arizona. There's now taxes that are being collected off that they are going to be making available for more research. And I can tell you that the research always follows the money, because obviously we can't do the research without the funds. But if funds become available, you will start to see much more research in this area. People that may have not studied cannabis or cannabinoids for years are going to get into business if they know that they cannot look at it for other types of purposes. So people might be looking at it for other types of pathologies and diseases, like let's say Parkinson's disease or dementia. So there's no doubt that there'll be other types of research looking at cannabis. One of the examples is that orthopedic surgeon came to me and says, you know, I see people that smoke both nicotine as well as cannabis all the time, and I want to know if it affects their bones because I think their healing rate is different. Well, that is something that nobody has ever studied, right? Nobody's actually said, hey, I wonder if cannabis, you know, long periods of time will actually affect bone healing negatively or positively. So, you know, there's a belief that maybe cannabis might actually help with bone healing. And so, and of course, that would help in something like pain as well. So those are the kind of things where once the money's available, you'll have more people doing research to sort of figure out what's the good and bad, again, of something like medical marijuana or cannabis.
So in, especially with this issue of pain management or dealing with chronic pain, where do you see the possibilities of cannabis in the field?
Well, I think that there's lots of potential. So again, I think that there should be growth in multiple areas. I'd love to look at the endogenous cannabinoid system to see if it changes. Tali's giving you a great example in migraine, but we don't know if that changes in neuropathic pain, diabetic neuropathy, chemotherapeutic induced pain that John talked about. I've done a lot of studies in cancer pain, and I know that we have certain types of cannabinoids that work really well in cancer pain, metastatic type cancer pain. And so I can see lots of growth in these areas once the studies are actually done.
And this question is kind of for all three of you. You obviously study pain management, but it has to do with cannabis, and it is an evolving field. Do you still face a little bit of backlash or even snickers in the back room where it's like, oh, these guys are just, helping potheads out or just, kind of spinning their wheels with something that's just really meant to get people high? Is there still that stigma even in academia?
Well, I'll start and then I'll pass around. But I would say yes. I think that there are people that definitely will have that type of attitude. I think we also in this field face the attitude that many people will say, oh, that's been studied for a long time and it doesn't work. And it's unfortunate because, again, if you look in the literature, they've studied one compound, they've studied THC. And it's unfortunate because people can be very, very biased right away about the idea that, oh, I tried that, it didn't work, you know, and again, people will say CBD, you know, well, I tried that, didn't work. Well, what you see on CBD in the street corners in the markets is not really CBD. There's been plenty of actual real research that actually showed that what's in a bottle is not necessarily what they say on the label because it's not FDA regulated. And so you have no clue what's actually in there. So people will say, well, it didn't work for me, but you don't know what the heck you were even taking. So so there's definitely that we have to continually overcome. And I think, and I'm sure my colleagues will agree, it just takes a lot of research to sort of figure out where does it work, where does it doesn't, where does it not work, what side effects are produced. And I think the future for all of us is to sort of say, what is the entourage? I'll go back to that word. What is the mixtures that we can use to synergize to get good pain relief without the side effects? And I'll pass it on to one of my colleagues here.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely the stigma. So I think Dr. Vanderaad did a really good job summarizing some of the challenges. I think, you know, even within pain management research, there are little subsets of people who study this pain or that pain. And, you know, we talk about the ability of these different strategies to mitigate pain. And I think in addition to, you know, how much of this compound versus that compound do you need to have if you're going to use, or, you know, can we use a more purified approach, like a pharmaceutical approach? It also comes down to when will it be effective? The other component to that is, you know, how long after insult is it going to continue to work with continued administration? And so even within academia, I think there's still some people who maybe overlook those features when talking about cannabis and its potential.
Yeah, so the worst bias I've faced in my research is actually from people in the cannabinoid field. It's not from others snickering at cannabis. It's from cannabinoid people that are like, oh, terpenes, that's nonsense. Entourage effect, BS. And, you know, not without much justification, because, again, there's not much data for this stuff, but there's really not much data against it either. It's pretty much unstudied. So I've faced some public comments from prominent cannabinoid scientists, you know, casting doubt on this in a way that I felt was unfair. But, you know, what else can you do other than get back in the lab and show that they're wrong, right? Keep publishing the data showing that it works, or maybe it doesn't work and I can go find something else to do. But then at least we'll know. So that's been my difficulty. And then the second greatest difficulties actually is Dr. Vanderaad is very correct that, you know, it's this field of research is becoming more accepted. It's easier to get funding and so on. But we still face practical hurdles. And in particular, the practical hurdle that irritates me to no end is the fact that we still have to obey federal rules in terms of the chemicals that we use, even if we're not spending federal money on this stuff. So to work with THC or cannabis, I have to have a Schedule I license, which is a very burdensome thing, which is also part of the reason I'm studying terpenes. They're not Schedule I, so I can play with them as much as I want. I don't have to have any special licenses. So that would be my perspective on it.
And I would add to that. I mean, you know, a lot of times you brought up Dr. Sisley and other researchers who are using government provided cannabis and THC. There's been, you know, one of the other hurdles as far as the practical hurdles is what is available from the government, you know, cannabis fields is very, very low content THC. Percentages of CBD are very low as compared to what's on the market, right? And so how translatable are some of those studies going to be when you put it into the context of what is available to a patient or a recreational user?
Just to further emphasize and build on that point, the market has left us so far behind in terms of the claims they're making, right? So they're out there claiming that if you take this terpene, it's going to make, you know, it's going to balance your life and make you happy. If you take this blend, this cultivar of cannabis, if you do, you know, Purple Dream, that's going to help your pain. If you take this other one, that's going to help your insomnia. There's not really any data behind any of this, right? So I think it's kind of on us scientists to catch up and help put some, you know, meat behind this, positive and negative, to help educate the public on what actually works and what doesn't.
From the other side of the coin, when you hear these sort of claims that, oh, CBD is the wonder, you know, cure all, or just make sure you take it and it'll get you to sleep no matter what, with, you know, Lemonol or something like that. How do you react to these sort of claims that seem ascientific at best?
I think you hear a lot in the field, but Eddie, and there's different ways to sort of perceive that. So Will some things work for some people and not for other people? That's going to happen for everything. So, you know, some people will say Tylenol works great for me. You know, that's all I ever take. And some people say it doesn't touch my pain or doesn't do anything for me. Same with opiates. You know, I've met many people that say opiates don't touch my pain. You know, yeah, they make me groggy, but they don't actually take care of the pain. And then some people say it works perfect. I've been taking Vicodin for 30 years. It works great for me. So first of all, there's the variance of individuals and their pain. So what works for one is not going to work for another. But I think most importantly, and I hope that the message gets out there, is that there's just, let me give you an example. So we've studied opiates really for the last 50 years, and even before that. But, you know, for the last 50 years, we've been studying opiates. And yet today, there's a lot of things that we still don't know anything about opiates. I mean, we have this opiate epidemic right now. You know, it's something that we predicted a long time ago. Cannabinoids are something that, again, we have not studied nearly enough. We don't have near the amount of research that we do on opiates. If you research opiates, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of papers, you know, so what we know on there, whereas if you look at cannabinoids, and especially if you look at real patient clinical trials, there's very, very few that are really good clinical trials. And so the key is that we need to do a lot more research and to be able to say to people, look, don't be too opinionated just because you tried THC one time and it didn't work. And whatever you were trying, you have really no clue exactly what that was. Because most of the time, again, as John points out, and as you point out, Eddie, the different plants have different types of concentrations. And I think Kelly's mentioned this too, that you have really no clue what's happening. And so there's a huge need for more research.
To just kind of wrap up on that idea, is there are some groups who are doing that right now, who are really going through looking from the scientific standpoint, not only anecdotally, but actually using measures of pain, you know, during use or during depression, and going through these different biomarkers, if they exist for the field or not, and saying, okay, what are these types of entourage ratios? Mm-hmm. Usually it revolves around THC and CBD, but what is effective in a large percentage of a population that has this, that, and the other, right? So those studies, I think, are underway. I know that I've had a few requests to review these articles. And so I think they're starting to come out. They're starting to come out from different areas of the US as well as globally. And so I think that we'll be starting to learn a little bit more in the coming years about, you know, what is effective for different pain states as well as other neurological disorders.
I want to thank my guests, UA Comprehensive Pain and Addiction Center researchers, Tally Largent-Milnes, John Stryker, and Todd Vanderau, one more time. Hopefully, as cannabis becomes more widely accepted as both medicine and recreational product, research into it and its compounds and their effects can be better understood and better utilized to help those suffering from pain. For those who want to learn more, I've included links to some of the doctor's research and work in the podcast's description. If you have a story about your struggle or someone else's with pain and how cannabis has affected that, I'd love to hear from you about it. You can reach out to me on Twitter or Instagram on my handle @ReporterEddie, that's all one word, or you can email me at ecelaya, that's ecelaya, @tucson.com. You can also find links to all of these different ways to contact me in the podcast description. Unfortunately, the next episode of Here We'd Go won't be appearing in 2 weeks. That's because the show will be moving to a once-a-week format beginning next week. That episode will explore the growing movement to expunge some marijuana possession charges in states where recreational cannabis is now legal. I hope you enjoyed yourself listening to this episode, and I hope you join me for our next episode. Until then, folks, keep growing towards the sun, because here we'd go.